This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
A caretaker is traditionally defined as someone who's charged with looking after a public building or a house in an owner's absence. They're the caretaker. In North America, we use that term of a caretaker to refer to someone who might be given that responsibility over a person or an animal. So maybe like we have family that's distant, that is maybe in hospice care. They have a caretaker taking care of them because we can't be there. And we know what that term means, right? We hear that, the caretaker. The person who's taking care of the day-to-day operations, the one with the boots on the ground, the one that's getting messy in all the details of life. So whether it's a building or a person, that caretaker's needed. A landlord might have the legal claim to the property, but it's the caretaker who keeps that piece of property managed. And we're caretakers of lots of things in our lives, aren't we? We maybe take care of our cars. So some of you yesterday, under the delusion that winter's over, you might have thought, man, this is nice weather. I need to take care of my car today. Let's get it washed. Let's detail this thing. But there's more snow coming. That's my prediction. I'm not a groundhog, but my name is Phil. So we're caretakers of our cars. We're caretakers of our homes. So again, the weather was nice a few weeks ago, and I finally took down Christmas lights off of my house. Now, some of you probably thought, he'll just keep them up all year because he loves Christmas. But no, I'm a caretaker of my home. We're caretakers of our children. We're caretakers of our elderly. And even caretakers of the earth. Wendell Berry is an author who famously opined, "The care of the earth is our most ancient and most worthy and after all, our most pleasing responsibility. To cherish what remains of it and to foster its renewal is our only hope." So, I mean, he's an environmentalist and that's great. We are given a stewardship of caring for this earth, right? So caretaking gets at that. It gets at our stewardship of resources on planet Earth. So there's people, there's things, we take care of these things. But what about the things that are beyond our care? Like, there are probably several things at any given moment that are spinning out of control when it comes to our lives. So who's taking care of that other stuff? Who's taking, in some cases, like, we ask the question, well, who's taking care of us? Like, taking care, I can't even take care of myself, right? Who's taking care of me? And I love how the hymn, How Firm a Foundation, puts it. This verse, "Fear not, fear not, I am with thee. Oh, be not dismayed, for I am thy God and will still give thee aid. I'll strengthen thee, help thee, and cause thee to stand, upheld by my righteous, omnipotent hand." Our great hope isn't how great of a caretaker we are, which doesn't diminish our responsibilities in the least. Our great hope is that underneath us, all around us, is the current of God's love. It's pulsing and it's working to care for us and work all things for our good. So like Amber just saying, above and behind us, Christ be all around us. He's our hope. He's the one we're putting confidence in. This is true for our lives, and as we'll see today, it's true in David's life. So let me bring you up to speed, or how we got to 2 Samuel 17. Let me go over the story one more time. After being anointed king over Israel, David's heart was knit closely to the God who chose him. And when enemies came, we see David, like 2 Samuel 5, he put all of his confidence in God, and God gave him direction, and as a result, the nation had victory. And so in 2 Samuel 7, God promised that this would be an eternal arrangement, that one of David's sons would be king and reign eternally someday. But in recent chapters, it's become increasingly obvious that neither David nor his sons were the types of people that God would establish eternally. And if he did establish that eternally, it would be a horrible situation for all kinds of people around them, right? They've all gone their own way. They've rejected God. They've despised his word. And God's given them over to their own devices. And like we've said over and over again, we know that God's doing this because he's absent. He's just pulling back his grace. And as a result, life is spiraling out of control as these people all go their own way. So in recent days, in particular, David's son Absalom has tried to grab the throne, and he's done more than try. He's actually thrown a coup, and David has left Jerusalem. And we tend to think that God's not in the details, or we can at first sight. And in today's passage, we're going to see how God's exercising his care through all this. I mean, it just is almost going to be like, wait, what? You're kidding me. You're the one behind all this? So we're going to see that unfold, and it's going to be hopefully glorious for us. I think it was John Piper who famously said that God is always doing 10,000 things in your life, and you might be aware of three of them. And we see this up close and personal in this story today. If you're a believer, I want you to have confidence in God's care. God's not left you. He's not abandoned you. He's promised. Jesus promised. Remember his last words on earth? I will never leave you or forsake you. I am with you always, even to the end of the age. And he is here with you, and he's caring for you. He's got your back. I want you to have a confidence in God's care. Whether you're aware of it or not, he is upholding you. And even if you're not a believer, I wonder what God is doing in your life. You might say, well, he doesn't have any right to me. Well, he does. He made you. He made you in his image. He has every right to you. He's the creator. He made you for himself. Your life's purpose finds its ultimate fulfillment in him. And I wonder how he might be working to get your attention or to help you see how glorious he is. So today, we're going to see God acting out of love and purpose. And I invite you to join me as we see three displays of God's sovereign care. Three displays of God's sovereign care. And let's begin by reading verses 1 through 14 of 2 Samuel 17. Here's what we read there. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue David tonight. I'll come upon him while he is weary and discouraged and throw him into a panic, and all the people who are with him will flee. I will strike down only the king, and I will bring all the people back to you as a bride comes home to her husband. You seek the life of only one man, and all the people will be at peace." And the advice seemed right in the eyes of Absalom and the elders of Israel. Then Absalom said, "Call Hushai the Archite also, and let's hear what he has to say." And when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom said to him, "Thus has Ahithophel spoken. Shall we do as he says? If not, you speak." Then Hushai said to Absalom, "This time the counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good." Hushai said, "You know that your father and his men are mighty men, and that they are enraged like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. Besides, your father is an expert in war. He'll not spend the night with the people. Behold, even now, he's hidden himself in one of the pits or in some other place, and as soon as some of the people fall at the first attack, whoever hears it will say, 'There's been a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom.' Then even the valiant men, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will utterly melt with fear. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and that those who are with him are valiant men. But my counsel is that all Israel be gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba, as the sand by the sea for multitude, and that you go to battle in person. So we shall come upon him in some place where he is to be found, and we shall light upon him as the dew falls to the ground, and of him and all the people with him, not one shall be left. If he withdraws into a city, then all of Israel will bring ropes to that city, and we shall drag it into the valley until not even a pebble is to be found there." And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, "The counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel, for the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel, so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom." This is God's word. Thanks be to God. So three displays of God's sovereign care. And the first way that we see God's sovereign care is that God often cares by working behind the scenes. And this is what we've seen in verses 1 through 14. Now, why do I say behind the scenes? Behind the scenes? Because of verse 14. As we were reading this, God wasn't nowhere in your brain, right? You're just going along going, well, what's going on? These two guys are giving advice, and they like the advice of the one guy over the other. What's going on? And then the writer tells us, well, this was all part of God's plan, and we're just going, what? Like, you can hear the record scratch, like, is this for real? Like, this is God's doing? So God's, a lot of times we just, you know, think like God's just waiting to see how it all plays out. But scripture here tells us God was working and ordaining what happened in accordance with his plan. And again, I'm not making this up to fit with my theological understanding, right? I'm not laying something on the text that's not there. I mean, what does verse 14 say? It's simply pointing out that God's ordaining this. So before we get there, let's back up and just look at how we got to verse 14. And we begin with Ahithophel's plan. So you might remember that Ahithophel started giving advice at the end of chapter 16. It ended with Ahithophel's counsel to set up a tent and for Absalom to go to the concubines on the roof. And then we were given this explanatory note that in those days, Ahithophel's counsel was like hearing God's word. So when this chapter begins with a moreover, we can see that Ahithophel had big plans for Absalom. He's the one that's giving the counsel, and when he speaks, wasn't there a commercial in the 80s, like with E.F. Hutton? When he speaks, people listen. So I was just a child in the 80s, so whatever. Some of you might have a better memory than me. But like when Ahithophel spoke, it was like, oh, yeah, that's what God wants us to do. It's like hearing God's word. And Ahithophel's plan is really a four-step program in verses 1 through 4, right? Number 1, I'll get 12,000 troops to arise and pursue David right now. That's part 1. Part 2, I'll come upon him, he'll be thrown into a panic, and all the people around him will flee. Number 3, I'll strike down the king. He's really the only one that you're wanting his life anyway. And number 4, I'll bring the people back to you as a bride for her husband, and this will cause the people to be at peace with you. And this plan seemed good to Absalom. It seemed good to the elders. His advice is careful, calculated, and concise. And like reading that, we're just like, yes, minimal loss and maximum impact. That's the way we need to go. But Absalom has second thoughts, and so this leads to Hushai's option, Hushai the Archite. Now remember, in the story, if you just catching up today, all the way back to, I think, chapter 15, as David's fleeing Jerusalem, at the end of chapter 15, Hushai the Archite, who's one of David's friends, came to him and said, hey, I'm going to go with you. And David said, nope, you're just going to cause me trouble if you go, but if you stay, then you can be of service to me, because somebody's got to give counsel other than Ahithophel's counsel. That's how we're going to win this. So Hushai's loyalty is to David. And he's put on the spot. Either agree with this guy who every time he speaks it's God's word, or disagree. And Hushai says, he begins with his opening remarks saying that this time, like it's only this time that Ahithophel's counsel is not good. And Hushai appeals to Absalom's logic. And he says, you know your father. You know his men. They're mighty. They're enraged. They're like a bear robbed of her cubs. And trust me, none of us want to meet a bear robbed of her cubs, ever. Right? David's an expert at war. He's not even going to be with the people. So that's the appeal to logic, right? Think about this. You know who your dad is. You know who his men are. Are there better fighters anywhere that you know of? And Absalom's like, no, there's not. Hushai appeals to caution. Your father's going to be one step ahead of you. In other words, he's going to have on the camouflage and the war paint. He's going to be expecting you to come. He'll be ready to pounce on the first attack. So there's an appeal to caution. We have an appeal to Absalom's vanity. Think about what the people will think if the battle doesn't go well. They're not going to like this. They're going to doubt you as the leader. They know what David can do. They don't know what you can do. The first sign of trouble, they're going to side with David. That's what Hushai is saying. The people's heart will melt with fear because they know that your father is a mighty man with the heart of a lion. Right? So we're not playing games here. This is for real. So, as we see in verse 11, Hushai's counsel is really to let all of Israel come from Dan to Beersheba. When we hear the Bible say Dan to Beersheba, it's like the person saying, hey, from sea to shining sea. That's how we would say it in America. And in Israel speak, it's from Dan to Beersheba, from sea to shining sea. We're going to wait for these numbers, and then we'll march and attack. We'll be as numerous as the dew on the ground. And Hushai concludes with a final appeal to vengeance. Then of him and his men, none will be left. We'll have this. Victory will be ours. And Absalom and all the leaders agreed with Hushai. And it's at this point in verse 14 that we learn that the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom. So God was going to have his way with his word. His counsel was going to prevail. Really, I think all that Hushai is trying to do is buy some time for his friend, right? He's trying, if I can just create a scheme where they can hit the pause button, that'll give David further time to escape. And then as we read this in verse 14, that this is actually the Lord behind this, that God's accomplishing his plans, it reminds us of Proverbs 21:1, right? The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord, and he turns it wherever he will. This is not a big deal for God to defeat the counsel of Ahithophel. And this is what God's doing in the moment. His sovereign care is being demonstrated by working behind the scenes. No one even knows God's at work until we get to verse 14. And none of us would ever know unless verse 14 was there, right? We might guess, we might think, ooh, like God's taking care of his anointed, but we wouldn't know. But verse 14 tells us this is what God's up to. He's coming from behind the curtain. He's coming from out of the shadows. And he's saying, here's what I'm doing. I'm up to this. So it's a great application for our life. How might God be working in your life right now? How might God be at work behind the scenes of your life? How might all the stuff that's happening, that all this stuff that seems to inconvenience you or cause you frustration, really might be God working behind the scenes to draw your heart up and out to him? What if God was doing that in your life right now? We know it's in his skill set. We know that he might be ordaining something. And you might be thinking, oh, this is just so frustrating. It can't be of God. Oh, this is so inconvenient for me. This can't be of God. And God might be saying, trust me, I'm working behind the scenes. I want your attention. I want you to need me. I'm your helper. I'm your glory. I'm the lifter of your head. You're going to trust me. And it takes the eyes of faith to see this. We wouldn't see this in chapter 17 unless God pulled back the curtain for us to see what's up. And I hope it's encouraging to you. It's so easy to go through this life and just think that like life's like spinning out of control and man, I just wish God would come through. Maybe God's coming through as it spins out of control. Maybe God needs to get you to the end of yourself so that you can say, man, I've exhausted all my efforts, God. I need you. Come, help me. God's at work. When you don't feel like he's working or your life is spinning out of control to such a degree that it feels like nothing is happening when it comes to you and God, would you consider that he might be working behind the scenes for his purposes and for your good? So as I look out at you all this morning, I know there's circumstances in your life. I know there's things that you all are dealing with. And what if we just entertained the notion for 1 second that God is up to something through that? How would it change our life? How would it change the way we view those circumstances? How would it change our ability to just, God, we trust you. Change us. God often cares by working behind the scenes. Secondly, our passage continues with another display of God's sovereign care, and it's seen as God's care can lead to lots of action. So just because God's at work behind the scenes doesn't mean that we're just passive and doing nothing. God's at work behind the scenes, and we're characterized by action. So let's see what plays out here, beginning in verse 15 down through the end of the chapter. Then Hushai said to Zadok and to Abiathar the priest, thus and so did Ahithophel's Did Ahithophel counsel Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus and so have I counseled. Now therefore send quickly and tell David, do not stay tonight at the fords of the wilderness, but by all means pass over, lest the king and all the people who are with him be swallowed up. Now Jonathan and Ahimaaz were waiting at En-Rogel. A female servant was to go and tell them, and they were to go and tell King David, for they were not to be seen entering the city. But a young man saw them and told Absalom. So both of them went away quickly and came to the house of a man at Bahurim, who had a well in his courtyard. And they went down into it. And the woman took and spread a covering over the well's mouth and scattered grain on it, and nothing was known of it. When Absalom's servants came to the woman at the house, they said, where are Ahimaaz and Jonathan? And the woman said to them, they've gone over the brook of water. And when they had sought and could not find them, they returned to Jerusalem. After they had gone, the men came up out of the well and went and told King David. They said to him, arise and go quickly over to the water, for thus and so has Ahithophel counseled against you. Then David arose and all the people who were with him, and they crossed the Jordan. By daybreak, not one was left who had not crossed the Jordan. When Ahithophel saw that the counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey, went off home to his own city. He set his house in order and hanged himself. He died and was buried in the tomb of his father. Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. Now Absalom had set Amasa over the army instead of Joab. Amasa was the son of a man named Ithra the Ishmaelite, who had married Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister of Zariah, Joab's mother. And Israel and Absalom encamped in the land of Gilead. When David came to Mahanaim, Shobi the son of Nahash from Reba of the Ammonites, and Machir the son of Amiel from Lodabar, and Barzillai the Gileadite from Regolim, brought beds, basins, and earthen vessels, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans and lentils, honey and curds, and sheep, and cheese from the herd for David and the people with him to eat, for they said the people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. So lots of action, right? Lots going on there. And that's how God's showing his sovereign care, through all this action. Now you might be tempted to overstep that first point and think that because God is exercising sovereign care that we can drift into passivity. We just need to see how God lets all this pan out. But this passage shows that isn't the case. God's working behind the scenes, so Hushai doesn't just say, well, you know, God's doing this, so we don't have to let David know. He'll just know by the Holy Spirit, and this will all be good. This isn't the case. One writer actually described this section as the excitement of God's providence. Knowing that God is in control, there's an excitement that's going on, and it's precisely because God is in control that all kinds of action happens, and it begins with Hushai communicating with David. So after all, now that the plan is known, Hushai has to get to the real plan, which is saving David. And this involved the priest, right? You remember that? Zadok and Abiathar, they tried to leave town with David, and David said, no, you need to go back. You'll be helpful to me there. And in verse 17, we have Jonathan and Ahimaaz. We've already met them, right? They're the sons of the priests. So they're going to be the messengers. And they're waiting at En-Rogel, which in Hebrew means the well of the spy. So isn't that just crazy in light of what we're about to read? The well of the spy. So here's how the plan would go. A female servant would come out of the city to get water like she always would and would deliver the news. And then it wouldn't be so noticeable to Absalom's spies. But Absalom was watching for this type of thing, and the spies went quickly. So Jonathan and Ahimaaz went quickly. They came to the house of a man in Bahurim who had a well in his courtyard. They went into the well, and the woman covered it and made it so that nothing was known of it. Absalom's servants came, and she hides them, and they returned to Jerusalem. So doesn't this sound a lot like another story in the Bible that you might have heard? And it's the story of Rahab hiding the spies in Jericho for Joshua. I mean, as readers, that's what we're reading and thinking, man, this is like exactly the same thing. Like she hid them on her roof. You know, she was hiding them and then, you know, rescued the city through that. So they're avoiding capture, and the men emerge from the well. They go and tell David. And then we're told of another reminder of the Joshua story, right? That all the people who are with him cross the Jordan. It's almost as, like this is the story of Joshua in reverse. Like it all went a certain way, and now we're going to replay it slowly in reverse with different characters. So now to get out of the city, out of the promised land, they have to be hidden, the spies, and they tell David, and then he crosses the Jordan and comes out of Israel. So, and I think the implication for us as readers is that, man, in the same way that God was with Joshua, God's with David. Right? This is just that the story in reverse. It's the same thing. And the rhythm of this story is even reminding us that God's at work here behind all these scenes. We have the action in verse 23 of Ahithophel's suicide. So why did Ahithophel feel like this was necessary? Well, I think on the one hand, he must have really loved being the royal advisor, right? He's really like set himself up, like he had worked hard to see that he was the man. You want to know what God thinks? Just ask Ahithophel. And then the first time somebody says, now what do you think? Well, wait, what? I'm Ahithophel. Don't you know who I am? Yeah. What do you got? So he must have really loved that. So now his counsel wasn't followed. That's one thing. Ahithophel had also, in his counsel, turned on God's anointed, right? So there wasn't much of a future for him. He wasn't like, let's say David wins the battle, which I hate to blow the story for you. David's going to win the battle, okay? What kind of future is there going to be for Ahithophel? Like, as it looks right now, probably not good. If you've given counsel to go destroy this guy out in the countryside, it's probably not going to go well for you if your employment is being a royal advisor. There's not much of a future for him. I do need to say, this passage, by the way, isn't encouraging suicide. So if you're having thoughts like this, this isn't saying, oh yeah, it's a great thing to do, step into this. No. Get help. Like, talk to someone. Grab somebody. Grab another Christian in this room, or grab a friend. We want to walk through this with you. This is, again, part of God's plan, right? And because Ahithophel's suicide is reminding us of another son of David who was betrayed by someone who was close to him. And what happened to that betrayer? He's going to commit suicide. So as New Testament readers of this story, we look back and go, wait, David was betrayed by someone close to him and he committed suicide? The son of David who became the king, who died and rose again, Jesus, he was betrayed by someone close to him, and that person committed suicide. So it's another way in which the son of David is experiencing everything that David experienced. It's just an amazing turn there. Well, the action continues there. We have all this business at the end of the chapter, right? Where God's servants care for David, that David arrives at Mahanaim. So Mahanaim in verse 24 is mentioned. It's significant. We've already seen this location once in 2 Samuel. It's where Ishbosheth had been anointed king of Israel way back in 2 Samuel 2:8. So we have Absalom nipping at David's heels, and they both crossed the Jordan. And we get all the details, right? Amasa is running Absalom's army, and by the way, he's a distant relative of Joab. So I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, depending on how you've read this 2 Samuel. Joab and his brothers are just kind of being scoundrels throughout the book, so, but they have shining moments occasionally. So it's kind of just strange that Amasa is a relative of Joab. He's running the army. And Israel and Absalom are encamped in the land of Gilead against David. And in Mahanaim, David is helped by people. We have all these people mentioned, Shobi and Machir. So if you want information on Lo Debar, it sounds like an 80s band, right? Lo Debar. El Debarge, Lo Debar. Okay. In 2 Samuel 9, we met Lo Debar when David, it's one of the nations that David attacked. And then we learn about the Ammonites in 2 Samuel 10. So people that David had kind of been at peace with before he had gone wheels off with Bathsheba, these people he's been at peace with, these foreigners, bring him all this help. And then we meet this guy named Barzillai. We're going to learn a lot about him in 2 Samuel 19. They bring David and his entourage beds, basin, earthen vessels, foodstuffs, because the people with him need to eat, for they're hungry, weary, and thirsty in the wilderness. So there are still those who are loyal to David, regardless of how his family might have turned on him. God's at work to provide for David, even when it seems like those closest to him won't. God's at work in each of these pieces of action. He's caring for David with news that leads to next steps. So he's caring for David, bringing him the news he needs. He's caring for David with the death of his betrayer. And he's caring for David with tangible help from friends. God's working behind the scenes, that's true, but God's also working in the actual busyness of life and all the action of this story. I love how Paul Tripp makes the connection for all this. So you might have heard this quote before, but it's really helpful, and it comes to play here again. Here's how he makes the connection, that for our lives, change typically takes place in 10,000 little moments, not in one life-altering event. The little moments of life are profoundly important precisely because they're little moments. We live most of our existence in these mundane, everyday moments. For every substantial life-changing moment, we experience 10,000 insignificant moments. The beautiful thing about the gospel is that Jesus Christ offers grace for each of these little moments. The Bible doesn't say that his mercies are new once a year. Like, no, Lamentations 3, 22 and 23 says his mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Jesus is named Emmanuel, not just because he came to earth once, but because he makes you the place where he dwells every day. This means he's present and active in all the mundane moments of your everyday life. In these moments, he's delivering every redemptive promise he's made to you. In these moments, he's working to rescue you from you. And by sovereign grace, your Lord will place you in 10,000 little moments that are designed to take you beyond your character, wisdom, and grace, so that you'll seek the help and hope that only can be found in him. In the lifelong process of change, he is undoing you and rebuilding you again into his likeness. And I think that's kind of what's happening here with David. That God's care is leading to lots of action. It's just seemingly mundane moments, right? He's just getting news. And oh, by the way, this guy dies. And all these people came to give him help. And what's it doing? It's building. God's got your back. You're not alone. He's using all these little moments to accomplish all that he intends to accomplish in your life. He's exercising care for that. So yes, God is working behind the scenes, but God's care can also lead to lots of action, lots of insignificant moments. So I want to talk about one more display of God's care that's seen. And so I'd invite you to turn with me to Psalm 63. Psalm 63. So, Psalm 63, let me read this, and then we'll make sense of it. The title of this psalm says, A Psalm of David When He Was in the Wilderness of Judah. And it says, O God, you're my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water. So I have looked upon you in the sanctuary, beholding your power and glory. Behold, your steadfast love is better than life. My lips will praise you. So I will bless you as long as I live. In your name I will lift up my hands. My soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips. When I remember you upon my bed and meditate upon you on the watches of the night, you've been my help. And in the shadow of your wings I will sing for joy. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. But those who seek to destroy my life shall go down into the depths of the earth. They shall be given over to the power of the sword. They shall be a portion for jackals. But the king shall rejoice in God. All who swear by him shall exult, for the mouths of liars will be stopped. Now, we aren't sure when this psalm was written, when he was in the wilderness due to Absalom, or when he was in the wilderness of Judah due to Saul. But it might be the case that, and we are for certain, that it was written in the wilderness. And as it relates to God showing care for David, God's demonstrating care for us in drawing us back to him so that we are, so that David's seeking him. That's how David begins this psalm, right? He's seeking God earnestly. He's in a dry and weary land. He's thirsty. He's fainting for God. We know that's true, right? All these helpers came and brought David all this assistance because they were dry and weary. They were thirsty, right? Having escaped all this. And in this moment, his heart's being drawn up and out to God. He has confidence in verse 7 that God will be his help. And while David holds on to God, he's going to sing for joy. He's going to cling to God and he's going to be upheld. Those who seek David's life would be destroyed. That's David's confidence. But David, the king, would be characterized by rejoicing in God. He would rejoice in God. God's care is causing David's heart to be filled with joy despite the wilderness situation. Back in 2 Samuel 17, God's care had allowed a plan to kill David to be thwarted. Or it seems like it's allowing this plan to kill David to be thwarted. And there's all these people that are coming to help him. And Psalm 63 helps us make the connection of the impact that God's care would have upon David's heart and the impact that God's care should have upon our heart. Right? When God's doing this kind of stuff, whether it's behind the scenes or through all the active details, God's drawing our hearts back to him. He's drawing our hearts to him. God's using all these things to draw us, to move us. That we're not going, yeah, good job, God. Thanks for taking care of me. No, but that we're, who am I in heaven but you? My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you. Your steadfast love is better than life. I'll bless you as long as I live. My soul is going to be satisfied in you. I remember you. I meditate on you. You're my helper. I rest in the shadow of your wings. I cling for joy. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. I'll rejoice in you. So this is what David's response is in the wilderness. This isn't David's response when everything's just going rosy and awesome. This is David's response when he's dry and thirsty and weary and overwhelmed and has nowhere else to turn. And it sounds just like the wilderness as he's escaping from Absalom. God's care often works that way, to draw our hearts back to him. That's what Psalm 63 is teaching. So in conclusion today, we've seen three displays of God's sovereign care. That God often cares, first of all, by working behind the scenes. He's caring, and this leads to lots of action. Not passivity, but action. Seeking him. And God is doing all this work to provide all this help for David. And for us. And God's care draws our hearts back to him. So as we wrap up this sermon today, that's, I think, what God's care, that's the end of God's care. That's the aim of God's care, the purpose of it. It's to draw us to him. James 4 would give a litany of responses for how we should return to God. And maybe we should listen to this. That God gives grace to the humble. And so we're encouraged to draw near to him, to humble ourselves before him and to seek him. Humbling ourselves before God means to quit functioning as if you're God and to actually trust him. So that's what it means to humble yourself. That God gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves. That's what God's calling us to. So today, if in this passage and in this message you've seen how God's care is moving towards us, the aim of this is to draw your heart back to God. So won't you quit running from him? Won't you quit just thinking that the answers are within you? That you just need to turn over a leaf, that you need to be impressive? And would you just draw near to him? Would you trust him? Believe that his care is for your good? I mean, how has God ultimately cared for you? He's ultimately cared for you in that while you were a sinner, Christ died for you. that he didn't just leave you in your sin, which he would have been perfectly just to do. Like, there's nobody in hell that deserves to be there, right? It's just what we deserve for our sin. The wages of sin is death. But God has provided care for you. He's provided grace by sending his son to live in your place, to die for your sin, and to rise again. So humble yourself. Embrace that care. Realize that all of that care for you and sending his son was so that you would be drawn to him, that you would lift your eyes and believe and trust. Put all your hope in him, that his care is for your good. And if you're a believer, because God cares for you, you know, one just quick scriptural application would be, we should be quick to cast our cares on him. So that's how the scriptures word it, right? Cast your cares on him because he cares for you, right? If we believe, if we're convinced of this, then this should be a reminder. You can offload all your worry and frustrations and all the baggage you're trying to carry around in life. You can just dump that, like trash getting dumped in the ocean or something. I don't know. You can just offload that to God. You can cast your cares on him because he cares for you. The God's not going, oh gosh, here they come with needs again. What am I going to do? No, it's who he is. That he wants your heart to get to a place where it says, Lord, I need you. Oh, take the mess of this. So I don't know what you're worried about this morning. You know, it might be health. It might be some job situation. It might be some relational pressure. It might be some sort of other concern. And what would it look like for you to just offload that and say, God, I trust you. You care for me, so therefore I'm going to cast that care on you. I'm just going to like shot put it right to you. You're going to take it. That's what he's calling us to. That's one application, right? Another aspect of this might be that you need to express your confidence in God's care by asking for his help, right? Related to that, just asking for his help in that area that's overwhelming you. Now, I realize for some of you that's like saying, hey, I don't know if you knew this or not, but the sun is bright when you look into it. You know, you're just thinking, yeah, I've tried, like, I've been overwhelmed before, and I've prayed about it, and yeah, that's probably what I should be doing. I think that's kind of like, we're just kind of meh about it, right? If we put an emoji on our whole, you know, my encouragement to ask God to help you with what's overwhelming you. I think if we put an emoji on that, you'd just be like, yeah, okay, sure. Yeah, I need to pray. That's true. And maybe you have. You've tried that. You've poured out your heart before him. And today, maybe the encouragement you need is just to not give up. To believe that he's for you. That he cares. That he's active. If I tried to give you a visual representation of what it looks like when you're overwhelmed and how God cares and comes through, I mean, just think about Christ, right? Look to him. God demonstrated his care for you by sending his son to die for us while we were still sinners. I mean, long before we would have ever anticipated the rescue plan or even known what rescue looked like, God was already on it. Like, God was already saying, okay, I'm going to beat you to the punch. I'm going to go ahead and care for you. I'm going to take away the thing that you most, give you the thing you most desperately need. I'm going to send my son, and he's going to do all this. And so we tend to think like, well, yeah, Jesus did all that, but, you know, what I'm really worried about is this thing. As if that's, like, greater than the sin you have against the Holy God. And so just put all that in perspective and trust him. Offload those cares. If you seek him, you're going to find him to be faithful time and again. And I think if you were honest, when you think about your past history of dealing with this and pouring out your heart to God in prayer, isn't it the case that he gave you some sort of relief? I mean, isn't it the case that after you prayed about that and offloaded it to him, there was help? Now, you might not think, well, he fixed it completely. But it is the case, right? He did help in some way. So trust him. He will be faithful. time and again. Try him. Just bank on his promises. Try him. So let's trust his sovereign care. That's the challenge for us. It was the challenge for David. I mean, right? As we're going to see next week and the next week, David's not quite over this. I mean, God's going to give David victory and David's still going to be sulking. You know, and it's... I mean, and then he's going to have friends talking to him and he's still going to be sulking and just kind of like, oh, well, I've kind of brought this on myself, you know. Let's just trust God's care. Let's trust him. Let's learn from David. Like again, 1 Corinthians says, these things were written so that we would know how to act, so that we can learn from history here. So let's learn from it. Let's not repeat these things. Let's be characterized by trust in God as he sovereignly cares for us. And as we do, we might be those people who glorify and enjoy him forever.